event that we might have a quorum, we'll call the meeting to order at that time. But let's go ahead and hear from Chief John Harrington from the Met Council, the Metro Transit Chief of Police in full uniform. And welcome to the commission, and go ahead and state your name, both of you, for the record, if you would, please.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for my invitation here. I'm John Harrington, H-A-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N. I am Chief of Police for the Metropolitan Transit Police.
Great. Madam Chair, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. As you know, at the last meeting in October, you had asked that we had, or asked the council to have someone available to respond to the transit overtime. Police overtime issues. So Chief Harrington came with me today to respond to whatever questions you may have.
All right, terrific. Did you have any opening statements, or?
Madam Chair, yes, if you will.
Go ahead.
The question about how Metropolitan Transit Police are using overtime, I think the answer to that really is that we're doing a really very good job of managing our overtime. I can tell you that I take overtime very, very seriously. As Chief of St. Paul Police Department, we had a huge overtime budget in the millions of dollars, and one of the challenges of being a Chief of Police is to balance the needs for emergency services and unplanned emergencies with the job of trying to create a operating budget that you can live within. And every year it was always a challenge of trying to fit what happened in the year into what the overtime budget was. Overtime is a operational necessity for police departments. We do not schedule our work as much as we respond to the emergencies that are created for us. There were years where you would come in, for example, and you would start out with the year hoping that you didn't have any homicides, but that was an unrealistic expectation if you were in a city of the first class, and at the end of the year you would count up how many homicides you had, and you'd figure out how much overtime you spent on each one of those homicides, none of which was planned, and all of which had to be responded to. In Metro Transit Police's case, we have a variety of different reasons why overtime is generated. It's generated first off, oftentimes simply because we have our call volume, and we have to be able to respond to that. A classic example would be a Friday night where your beat cops are getting ready to get off the shift at midnight, and a huge bar fight breaks out in downtown Minneapolis near the transit hub. The cops are due to get off at midnight, but it's now 12:30, and they're still there trying to help Minneapolis out in terms of the fight. That's going to generate overtime, and the arrests that happen after that are going to continue to generate overtime after that. Late calls require officers to stay for overtime. If an officer is due to get off at 7 o'clock and at 6:30 a call comes out in their area, they are going to respond to that call. But the call may take an hour or 2 hours to actually process, in which case they're now over time in terms of their shift assignment, and they're going to generate some overtime that way also. We do callbacks for overtime also. Canines, for example, we have explosive detecting dogs. If we have a suspicious package on a train or at a station, and if no canine is on duty, we only have 4 canines that have to cover 365 days a year, 24/7. So you will have to call somebody back in. Last week we had a shooting on one of our buses. When that happens, a detective had to be called back in from home. It was an evening shooting, about 7 o'clock in the evening. That detective and his crew had to come back in to work that crime scene and work that investigation for the next 24 hours as we move forward. Crash investigations involving buses and trains, once again, the crash experts don't work 24/7. As a consequence, you're going to call them back in. Community meetings are another reason that we generate overtime. I sent a Somali officer out recently. We're trying to recruit for the next generation of Metro Transit cops. His shift normally gets done at 7. The Somali community group wanted to meet at 8, and so he stayed late to go to that community meeting. Oftentimes our beat cops, which normally start about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, are called to meet with BOMA, the Business Officer Owners and Managers Association. Those meetings are oftentimes breakfast meetings, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, but we're meeting with our business partners, and so we send our beat cops to do that. That is overtime because it's not during their regular shift. Training generates overtime on occasion where you have training that might go for a week and the officers are going to have to go to the training during their days off. And then finally, court by contract is an overtime issue. The majority of the overtime, I think, that is planned overtime is special event overtime. And Metro Transit is very much tied into the special events in the state of Minnesota. The average Viking game requires us to bring about 22 officers in to work the Vikings game. That's the folks to work the buses, the light rail, and the North Star. And so 22 extra officers need to come in. But they don't need to come in for a 12-hour shift. They only really need to come in for between 4 and 6 hours. And so it is far cheaper to have them come in on an overtime shift to do it that way than to try and hire 22 extra officers, which wouldn't be needed every day. The Twins games are another place that we have overtime, and then all of the other special events that involve transit during the course of the year. All of the overtime, with the exception of the court times, is all managed by either a lieutenant or a sergeant. It requires their authorization for someone to get the overtime. So it is not a matter that officers are typically being able to put themselves on shift. They are authorized by a command staff person or by a supervisor to do overtime. The last category of overtime that is both necessary and, in fact, doesn't affect our general fund is our Homeland Security dollars. Every year, Metro Transit applies for Homeland Security dollars in the nature of about $150,000 in overtime. The only way we can spend that money is in overtime. We cannot hire full-time staff on it because the money is time-stamped and you would have tails that would exist long past that. So that $150,000 plus is overtime that we are reimbursed for, so it doesn't come out of our general fund. In summation, I think Metro Transit is doing a really good job of holding the line on overtime. Our overtime budget is a fraction of what other agencies who have far smaller jurisdictions but much larger numbers of staff have. I really do believe that we have done a great job of holding the line on what we will allow overtime for, and to make sure that, to the extent possible, the state dollar is taxed as little as possible in meeting Metro Transit's goals.
Thank you, Chief. A couple of questions that I can think of. One is the Twins games and those sorts of things. You know those are coming. And there's no way to schedule people so that doesn't equal overtime. In other words, don't schedule them on a Tuesday because you know you're going to need them on a Friday night. There's no way to look forward in your calendar and see that you're going to have this need for 22 extra cops or whatever and plan accordingly.
Madam Chair, yes, there is a way to do that, but given the regular schedules, we're staffed with 69 full-time officers, and those full-time officers, which are the ones which would be called in for overtime, typically on an average day, a third of the department is actually operating in regular response mode, on boards, on trains, working the beats, and working response cars. So that leaves a group that are on days off, and then a group that you could call in, but there are numerous days, especially with the twin schedule because it is so large, where you could not get 22 additional officers in without calling them in off of their days off and still be able to staff the streets. And so we use part-time officers and we use overtime to balance that out.
Okay. I was reading in one of the newspaper articles that the amount that that you folks spend on overtime is double what I believe it was either the Minneapolis or the St. Paul cops, what their percentage of overtime was. I think one was 4%, 4 or 5%, and you were around 9%. And so why would how would that be accounted for, I guess? The difference in, you know, if they can schedule it in one way, why can't you do the same so that there's less overtime?
Madam Chair, I believe that is an inaccuracy in the article. The amount of overtime we expend, that's general fund dollars, is about 5% of our payroll budget, not 9%. We offered to the paper when they were doing the article the fact that of that overtime that they wanted to cite, they were misidentifying a certain amount of those dollars. $50,000 of the money that they cited is, in fact, canine money. We are required by contract to give the officers who have the four canines an hour a day to take care of their dogs. That is additional money. It is scheduled, but it is not in the traditional sense overtime dollars. So that's $50,000 out of the $550,000 that they were looking at. $159,000 of that money was, in fact, Homeland Security money, and the only way you can spend that is, in fact, in overtime dollars. You can't hire people with that. So that's $200,000 out of the $550,000. That brings us down to about $350,000. When you then look at the fact that we didn't spend all of our overtime budget, we spent actually about $300,000 in general fund dollars, and that out of a $5 million budget is far less than 9%. It's not even close to the 9%. So I would argue that the article was not completely accurate in terms of its depiction that we are spending 9%. The other piece of that, though, is that as you get larger departments, there's an economy of scale that you reach at certain points. If you have 600 officers, if you have a third off, and we'll just use that as a kind of a common denominator, that means you have 400 officers that are working. Well, it's a lot easier to pick 22 cops out of that 400 to come in and work. When you have 60 officers and you have a third off, if you pull that 22 extra officers in, basically somebody's coming in on their day off. It's we just aren't large enough to be able to achieve what Minneapolis State Patrol and St. Paul are able to achieve simply because we're not as big as they are.
And if you could just clarify something for me, too. Where do the lines of the transit police and, say, the Minneapolis police, where are those lines drawn? Like you gave the instance of a bar fight near a transit station when the Minneapolis cops were supposed to be getting off, or maybe your folks were. Where is that crossing line of where the Metro Transit cops are actually assisting or even maybe taking the place of Minneapolis cops? How do you work with those cities?
Madam Chair, the enabling legislation that created Metro Transit Police, which is about, no, it's coming up on our 20th anniversary, created us as a secondary police department. We exist to have primary service where there is a transit vehicle, where there's transit property or transit facilities. That's where our primary jurisdiction is. But having said that, even in the enabling legislation, what it stated was that the home department, the local jurisdiction, has really primary jurisdiction on investigations. And so in the case of Minneapolis, a fight breaks out of the warehouse district. Minneapolis has come out. They're trying to push the crowd out. Where's that crowd likely to go? It's likely to go to the light rail station at the Twins, by the Twins place. So now all of a sudden I'm going to have hundreds of intoxicated, happy people moving in the direction of the light rail station. So we're there to try and maintain order at the light rail station. At the same time, we're also responding to calls for assistance that Minneapolis might put out, saying officer needs assistance, or there's a crowd, or there's a fight. So we would come in as at the invitation of Minneapolis to assist them. And then at the same time, we all have also have our own responsibility to make sure that we are policing the transit station, the buses that they would be getting onto, so that there is not a continuation of the fight or a continuation of the disruption on transit. Kind of the classic example of where that line gets drawn would have been this fall when we had, as I recall, the number 40,000 zombies during the zombie crawl. The Minneapolis police, St. Paul police, and Metro Transit police all worked cooperatively. We largely worked on getting them on and off the buses. We got them on and off. A lot of them rode light rail, as we found out later on. And so as Minneapolis was closing up the streets over at Cedar, trying to get them out of the streets, they had to go someplace. And where they went was they went onto our buses and then went onto our light rail system. And so we had to have cops that could police the transit systems as a result of Minneapolis's actions.
Thank you. Any other member questions? I see we've added a couple of folks. Welcome to the commission. Do you have a question, Senator Dibble?
Yes. Exactly. How many brains did we avoid from being eaten as a result of your
Senator Dibble, Madam Chair, I wish I could bring a video for you. I was out working that night, and the area immediately adjacent to the Cedar Avenue, they were strewn about the street in front of the Taco Bell there. It looked like we had lost a number of casualties from that night. So as I understand, we can expect an even bigger zombie crawl next year, and I hope that St. Paul's ready for their half of that. So.
Yeah, they are friendly zombies.
Yes, they were. I agree there. Staggering, lurching, and sometimes hungry, but largely friendly. So.
Okay, Chief Harrington, no other questions? I did ask Mr. Shetland late last night, and he didn't get the email until this morning, but I would like some data on the, if you have it. I don't need names or anything. I just would like to know that maybe the top 10 overtime recipients in the force and their ages and years of service with the Transit Police. So if you could provide that for the committee, that would be very helpful. And thank you for being here for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All righty. And I believe we're ready to go over the budget. And we have Mary Bogie, is that correct?
That's correct.
Very good. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Mary Bogie, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Met Council.
Go ahead and proceed.
So, Madam Chair, today we're here to present both our operating and capital budgets and our levies. And because you had a copy of our public comment draft, I added this slide to the presentation that we were ready to prepare to give in October. And this just shows the differences between our public comment draft and that which the council adopted on December 12th. And so if you looked at our public comment draft, we decreased our budget by $1 million for our small business loan disruption program that we thought would carry over into 2013, but those loans will be dispersed by the end of the year.
Can I just stop you right there real quickly? do you have information on what businesses are going to get that? Is it primarily along the Central Corridor, those businesses?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Those businesses along the Central Corridor line, and they agree to stay on the line for 5 years if they receive one of these loans.
Okay. And when will those be dispersed? Do you still have some money that needs to be dispersed?
Madam Chair, there has been dollars dispersed already, about $1.9 million, I think, and the remaining then would be dispersed in December here. So
okay.
All of the money will be dispersed.
And what balance is left there to disperse?
Madam Chair, the total amount that the council was putting into the program was $2.5
million. Okay. Thank you.
So the next couple items there, $526,000 decrease, and I'm going to jump to the third one, $699,000 increase in what we're passing through to the transit providers, are the result of getting further along in the budget process. So we get the budgets from all of the transit providers. We get the November forecast, and we put that into our revenue allocation model and bring reserve balances down or fill them up as funds are available to do that from motor vehicle sales tax. The third bullet point there is $211,000 for our Office of Diversity and Equal Opportunity. We are supporting the Viking Stadium DBE goals, and they are paying for that. So that's revenue in and expense out for helping them out with that. Also, our 2013 capital program has been updated to reflect amendments that go through the council between the time that we adopt the public comment draft and we adopt the capital budget. So the next slide here just shows a look at our schedule for the budget at the council. We start way back in the March-April time frame putting together our operating budget and our capital budgets. In July, we approve our wastewater rates, and that's a conversation with the communities that we have that needs to occur so they can put their budgets together. In August, we adopt our preliminary operating budget and levies. October, our preliminary capital program, and then late October, we adopt our public comment drafts. That opens a public comment period where we take public comment prior to adopting our budget in December. And we just adopted our budget last week, December 12th. We had just a few comments this year. Last year, we had a lot of comments, and it was mostly explaining the difference between market value credits and exclusions and just some confusion out there in the public. This year, I think we had 12 phone calls. Some of them were, how do I file for a property tax refund? A couple were, explain to me what's in the metro district tax. And then a couple of them were from the city of Shoreview, where they had a watershed change from a city to joining with another watershed district, and it was simply a movement on the property tax statement from a city line down to the metro line. So So very few comments, but we do give opportunity for public comment. So finally here we're getting into what our operating budget looks like, and the slide here shows a breakdown of our operating budget compared to last year. And I further broke that down between what we use for operations, debt service, and pass-through. So you can see that we had a $780 million budget in 2012, and our proposed 2013 budget is $828 million. This next slide shows how that change from year to year looks in our budget. So in the operations, the blue segment, that's a $36 million change. That's made up of about $20 million in inflationary pressures. So it's about 3% inflation, plus our employee contracts that Wes Koistra talked a lot about the last time we met in October. It also includes $7 million for the startup of the Central Corridor Light Rail Line, and $2 million for the startup of the Cedar Ave BRT. $2 million for some scheduled plant maintenance in our environmental services area. And then $5 million for Metro Mobility. That $5 million for Metro Mobility is a federally mandated program, and we're expecting growth of about 10% in ridership there.
Okay, if I might. Could you go into the inflationary pressures? Explain that a little bit more. That, to me, is kind of vague.
Madam Chair, I certainly can. So we use an inflationary factor of about 3%, 3.1 I think it is, for our general type of expenses. We also have fuel in there, and that's maybe a little bit bigger inflationary pressure. We do a fuel price hedging, and so we're pretty certain on about 90% of our fuel costs throughout the next budget year. And so that increase would be in those inflationary pressures as well. And then, as I said, when Wes Koistra was here back in October, he talked about some of our labor contracts and what changes were in those, and that would be the other big thing that would be in that number. The largest portion of it by far is just inflation, 3.1%.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
The next category there is our pass-through grant and loan programs. That's a $15 million change year to year. $7 million of that is related to our HRA rent subsidies, and that's federal revenue in and federal revenue out, or just a pass-through. An additional $4 million for our livable communities transit-oriented development grants. An additional $4 million for our suburban transit providers of MVEST. If you remember, they were on a freeze to their 2011 levels in July. In July, they will come off of that freeze, and that $4 million just represents coming off of that freeze. And then $1 million in I&I grants, inflow and infiltration in our environmental services. Our debt service is down by $3 million, and that's simply a cash flow thing. Needs for paying off bonds, what we issue year to year, so it's just a cash flow difference. This next slide breaks down the operations portion of our budget by division, by category, and by sources of funds. So our 2013 operations budget is $572 million. The pie on the upper left side shows uses by division, and you can see the transportation budget is about 74% of the council's overall budget. Environmental services comes in next at about 22% and $127 million. And then community development, 14, and regional administration, 6 million, make up about 4% of our budget.
Ms. Foggy, where would parks come into that? Is it is that under community development?
Madam Chair, they will be in our community development, but this is our operations budget.
Okay.
So that portion that operations is in there, and in our pass through, you will see where we pass through dollars for parks as well. So we'll catch that on the next slide as well.
All right.
Or on the next several slides. So on the right-hand side, you see our uses by category, and you can see that the council's budget is 61% salaries and benefits. Transit programs are another $65 million, or 11%. Material supplies and consulting contracting, about 8% each. And then other, about 12%. In the other are things like rent, utilities, insurance, those kinds of things. The bottom slide there shows our sources of funds. And MVEST $181 million, 32% of the budget. Wastewater fees, 21%. Fares, $101 million, or 18%. Some federal revenues there. And we also have a use of reserves of $16 million, and I'll talk about that a little bit more as we move into each of the division budgets. So the next slide is our transportation operations. So we're just taking that slice, which is transportation, and that's $425 million. And familiar to before, our uses by department on the left side. And it shows that Metro Bus is by far the largest portion of the transportation budget at 68% of the budget. But I also want to point to Metro Mobility. Metro Mobility at $53 million is 13% of the budget. And I did say a little bit earlier, and I'll say it again, that we're expecting 10% growth in Metro Mobility, federally mandated service. A rather large part of the budget for a smaller share of the ridership, and we'll look at that as we look at ridership slides. As would be expected in our uses by category, salaries and benefits take up 60% of our budget, so the largest share there. Sources of funds, as we look at MVEST now, 43% of the council's budget is MVEST, $181 million.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And on this slide, do you have some forecasts for MVEST revenue? You know, that fluctuates. You know, when I was on the council, we always worried about it. I know you worry about it. Looking into the future, what are you seeing in terms of fluctuations in that particular revenue source?
Ms. Bogie, Madam Chair. We use the state's forecast for our MVEST. And we budget 95% of that forecast in the current year. And then in the subsequent year, we budget, again, 95% plus anything that was above 95% in the previous year. So the state forecast for us is the truth until we know differently.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, as you know, and I know Senator Dibble knows as well, and those folks who deal with the Transportation Committee, Mark knows this as well, is that we are fully phased in on the amount of motor vehicle sales tax that the council receives from the constitutional amendment that passed in 2007. We had a phase-in between 2008 to 2012, so now we are fully phased in at the 36%. So when we talk about volatility with motor vehicle sales tax, now we are at the 36%. There's no phase-in amount that's going to provide any wiggle room in that. So when we talk about how the council is currently funding our transit operations through the general fund, which continues to be a discussion we have every year, and then now that we're phased in at the 36% of the motor vehicle sales tax, that if there's any volatility in that MVEST, it actually affects our budget even more because we are, again, basing everything off of the state's forecasting, and that's why we do the 95% and then catch up the additional 5% or whatever's left in the following year just because it allows us to manage that volatility.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. Bogie.
Madam Chair, and I will take that just a step further, and the use of reserves that we see in the transportation budget is directly related to drawing down our MVEST reserves from the previous year as we build those into the budget. The sources also show a state appropriation of $52 million, and that brings us back to the base appropriation from previous years. This next slide shows our transportation pass-through of $25 million. This is the money that goes through the MVEST part that is statutorily to the suburban transit providers, as well as our regionally allocated MVEST. MBTA and Southwest will both be receiving regionally allocated MVEST this year, $4.8 million for MBTA and $600,000 for Southwest. In all cases, we've been able to bring up the suburban transit providers' reserves just above their minimums. This next slide shows our regional ridership. We're projecting 93 million rides for 2013. It's about a 9% growth over the last 5 years. And in particular, again, Metro Mobility is showing a growth of 10%. So that's that pink slice right at the top there, 1.6 million to 1.7 million rides. And that 1.7 million rides then represents 13% of our transit budget at about $53 million. I'm going to move on now to environmental services operations. And again, I'm still just talking about the operations portion of the budget. The upper left side shows our uses by department. And you'll see that treatment services represents about 60% of our budget, or $76 million. Year after year, we have 99.9% compliance or better in our wastewater facilities. The upper right slide shows our uses by category. And again, salaries and benefits take up the majority of our budget, about 50% for environmental services. And the bottom chart shows our sources. And the environmental services operations are primarily funded by fees, municipal wastewater fees, 108 million or 85% of the budget, industrial charges. And here we also have a use of reserves. And we use that use of reserves in this case as part of our rate mitigation. This budget does include a 3% increase to the municipal wastewater fees.
Could I interrupt you there for a minute? Representative, or so Senator-elect Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just, before we leave this page, I wanted to ask about the Metro Mobility. You're expecting a 10% increase. Have you projected, given the aging of the population, what this is going to look like? I mean, this is for one year, I assume. So are you projecting out like 5 years so we can get kind of a handle on what that's going to happen because of the aging of the population and the demographics?
Ms. Boak.
Madam Chair, we do internally do an operations budget that goes out about 6 years, and we do see significant growth in Metro Mobility.
Representative Scalzi.
And then what will happen with that? Are you going to be asking for more money, or is something else going to be suppressed to make up that difference, or have you projected how we're going to handle that in the future?
Madam Chair, Senator-elect Scalzi, that is a question that we deal with every day, and those are discussions we have with Minnesota Management and Budget. We talk about the administration regarding this issue. We'll also be speaking with the legislature about this as we head into this next session, because it is certainly something on the horizon that is going to be very costly. We know that we have a set general fund amount that we'll be discussing, and as I mentioned, we have the motor vehicle sales tax as well, and we have to fund our entire transit operations out of those. So one of the issues with Metro Mobility is that these are our users who have no other way to get around. And we are required by federal law to provide this through the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so we are facing the issue that you just brought up, and we have to find a way to provide that service. So it was a very poignant question, because that is something that we're going to have to deal with here this next legislative session and beyond, because it really is, and this is a cliche, but the silver tsunami is coming, and we are seeing it in just our base budget this next year. I mean, we're talking 10%. So, and you can just see on the amount of rides that we provide versus the overall system that it's very expensive service as well. So I appreciate the question. I don't have an answer for you, but I can tell you that we spend a lot of time sitting there trying to ask ourselves how we're going to address this. And I think something needs to happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we'll continue on with environmental services. And there was one more point that I wanted to make on this slide, and that is that in previous legislative sessions, the legislature gave the council the ability to shift from our wastewater to our SAC because the housing development was putting pressure on the SAC charges. This budget does not use that shift. We have seen enough recovery, economic development recovery in the housing industry, that we don't anticipate the need to use that shift in 2013.
And the SAC, Madam Chair, is the service availability charge, is the hookup.
This next slide shows that even though we are proposing or have adopted a 3% rate increase for wastewater, that we are still very competitive with our peers. And you'll see that the Twin Cities rate is 216 dollars there, and as we compare that to our peers, we are still in the top five.
I have one question. What's Denver doing that makes it so much less? Have you investigated that?
Madam Chair, if Jason Ouellette was here, he would be able to answer that, but I...
He's not.
All right, thank you.
This next slide breaks out our community development operations, $13.9 million. The pie charts, again, break out by department, by category, and by source of funds. Salaries and benefits are 51% of our uses by category. In our budget here, we show federal sources of $6.3 million. That is the HRA administration piece of our budget. The sources also show property taxes of $4.8 million, and that is the general purposes portion of our levy that goes to community development. Next slide shows our pass-through for community development, and this was your question about the parks operations and maintenance as well. So our sources of fund, federal dollars, $56 million. Those are passed through to the landlords who are providing housing. So you'll see on both sides the uses and the receipt of federal funds. Also, state revenues, $9.9 million. Property taxes, $17 million. The property taxes support our grant and loan programs, and then the state funding is for operations and maintenance. The last operations portion I'm going to talk about is our regional administration, and that's $39.7 million. The biggest portion of regional administration is information systems at $18 million, or 46% of our budget. Human resources comes in at 4.7%, or 12%. Finance, $6 million, 15%. Uses by category, again, salaries and benefits. Software maintenance, $5 million there. Consulting and contractual, about 13% of our budget. Sources of funding for regional administration are, again, a portion of the general purposes levy, as well as interdivisional allocation. We charge our regional administration up to our operating division, so you would have seen in the transportation environmental services budgets this allocation from regional administration.
Ms. Bogie, I'm just wondering what the Met Council might be doing, and I don't know if you're the right person to answer this question or not. Perhaps Mr. Shetland can help with that. But what kind of things are you doing to keep the costs down and reallocate funding sources while still providing adequate sources? And even if it is to the point where, you know, you have to ask the legislature or the feds for more flexibility to allocate funds from different places, to have more freedom to do that, or what kind of things are being done in that area?
Great. So, Madam Chair, one example of that would have been when we asked for permission to be able to use the wastewater fees to supplement the SAC when we saw the housing market declining. And so that's where we're trying to shift funds from one purpose to help up for another purpose. We don't have that opportunity to do between our operating divisions, so you can't use wastewater fees to fund transportation operations. In the transportation area, we do a lot of monitoring of ridership and looking at routes that are better performing and routes that are less performing and shifting what we call harvest and reinvest, so maybe pulling a route and adding more capacity to another route that's seeing more demand. So we do a lot of that kind of thing throughout all of our budgets, looking at where the best place for our resources are.
And, Madam Chair, we did a few years ago seek legislation that allowed us to use some flexibility from our livable communities funds to put into our transit system, but that was done at a time when the economy was down. Cities weren't using our livable communities funds, and we said those would be the last dollars in, specifically because those funds were levied for a non-transit reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to come to the legislature to do that. We used a very small amount of that just because, again, the purpose for those funds were to be used in our livable communities account, not in our transit system. And in order for us to do that, we came to the legislature, and they had to give us, you gave us, a one-time authority to do that, and that has since expired. And the good news is that now we are finding that with the economy recovering, that the cities are starting to use those dollars again. So any type of flexibility that we're seeking has to be done through the federal, or excuse me, through the state government or through the federal government, and the council does not have the ability to move those monies with all by ourselves.
Right. Has any attempt been made to allow for more flexibility in helping out the businesses on the Central Corridor? I mean, the 5-year, you have to stay there 5 years, and some of the other criteria for helping some of those businesses is, have you looked into any more flexibility in regard to those funds?
Well, Madam Chair, I think as Mary stated earlier, we have $1 million again that's going into that program, $2.5 million from the council overall. We are partnering with the city and other folks in order to provide that type of assistance. And at this point, you know, we will see where we go with that. But I expect that if there is an issue down the road, that we will continue to have those conversations with our partners and see what we can do. We also anticipate in opening the line here within the next year and a half. And also, most of our heavy construction is done in those corridors. So we anticipate that hopefully the impact of the businesses will be mitigated with those dollars that we're presenting. And hopefully, then with the heavy construction being done, that the hopefully the impacts won't be as heavy as they experienced during the construction.
Because I am still hearing from some of those businesses. So I just want to make you aware that even though the construction is not in front of their businesses anymore, they're still struggling. So, all right, go ahead.
Chair, I'm ready to move on to the capital program.
Sure.
Just first slide here talks about some of our capital program principles, and that's that even though we have transportation, environmental services, community development, we're still looking at an organization-wide unified plan. The primary focus of our capital budget is to preserve existing regional infrastructure. It's resource constrained, and by that I mean that it's balanced to our anticipated resources from federal, state, and regional sources. It's also contingent on obtaining those capital and operating funding. I will say it is just a plan. If those funding sources do not come true, the plan does not move forward. This next slide shows our unified capital program, and I pulled it all the way back to 2005 to show that projects stay in the capital program until they're closed. And so that big jump we see back in 2005 is the Hiawatha Light Rail project, because that program is not yet closed. We have a couple of car purchases that we're pending delivery on, and until we take delivery of those, we won't be able to close out that project. So we see that kind of big blip back in 2005 that still is a part of our authorized capital program. But will be closed out as soon as those cars are delivered. The capital program on the red bars on the chart, those are projects that have been authorized in our capital program. The green bars on this chart represent closed projects as we move forward in the capital program. And then the blue bars represent the planning part of our capital program. This next highlighted area shows our capital improvement program, and that's our 6-year plan. So that covers for what the council adopted last week, the calendar year 2013 through 2018. Our capital improvement program is $3.3 billion. Again, it includes both planned portions and authorized portions. The projects cannot move into the authorized portion of the capital program until the funding has been secured. So not just identified, but the appropriations made or the full funding grant award made, things that make the money available to us. The next highlighted area represents our capital budget. So that's the spending that we expect to occur in the first year of the capital program. And you'll notice in the first year of the capital program that part of that bar is still in the blue. And that's because we have a different calendar year than both the state and the federal government. And it's our expectation that as the state has its budget appropriations made and as the federal government makes its appropriations, that we will amend into our capital program those funds for parks and for transit programs. So this is another look at the capital improvement plan, again, the six-year plan, $3.3 billion, and how it breaks out by division, by objective, and by sources. As you can see, transportation is the largest portion of our capital program at 70%, and looking at the right side chart, transitways are the biggest portion of that at $1.6 million, and that is representative of the Central Corridor and the Southwest program being in our planned and authorized budget. If not for those transitways, 70% of our budget would be focused on preserve. Our sources of funds, regional borrowing at $1 billion, CTIB, state funding, and federal. The federal reflects the 50% share of the transitway projects and an 80-20 split on our preserve infrastructure, buying buses, replacing buses, things like that. Next slide, again, just breaks down the transportation portion of the CIP at $2.3 billion. Again, the upper left breaks down by uses by category, and transitways being the largest portion, uses by objective, and sources of funds. This next slide breaks down the transitways of $1.6 billion to the different components. Again, this includes both things that are planned in our CIP as well as things that are funded in our CIP or authorized. Southwest Light Rail, $1.2 billion. The remaining part of Central Corridor Light Rail, $272. I-35, Interchange, Streetcar Train Program, and so on. This next slide just breaks out transportation over the 6 years of the CIP, and you can see that portion which has been authorized, or like I said, the funding secured for, and that which is planned, and that's the blue portion. Again, things don't move into the authorized portion of the budget until the funding has been secured, and a plan is simply that. It's a plan. Move on to environmental services, and their CIP is $801 million. That's split kind of 60-40 between interceptors and treatment services. 68% of their budget is focused on preserving, 22% on expanding, and 10% on improving existing infrastructure. Sources of funding for environmental services is primarily regional borrowing. So 94%, or $749 million, comes from regional borrowing, and about 6% comes from a pay-as-you-go program. This next slide, with the red lines all over, represents our 600 miles of sewer lines. The green little squares on the slide represent our seven plants. And this budget has an addition of East Bethel and a relocation of the Hastings plant within the plant. Next slide just gives you a look at the interceptor rehabilitation projects that we have in the Environmental Services Capital Improvement Plan. You can see that we have projects in Brooklyn Park, Burnsville, Hopkins, Lake Minnetonka, Minneapolis, Plymouth, Savage, and Shakopee. These are primarily rehabilitation or replacement of corroded pipes. The next slide, again, shows just the environmental services portion of the CIP broken out by year. Authorized about $457 million, planned $344 million. Next slide is our parks and open space capital improvement program. Uses by category, 80% of our parks CIP is for parks agencies. We have some pass-through of directly from the state through to the parks agencies, and about 18% represents land acquisition. Uses by objective, 48% improve, 25% expand, and 27% preserve.
Ms. Bogey, just to, if I might interrupt you, on the land acquisition, I know local governments have to have a 25% buy-in to that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I do have a slide coming up on that.
You do? Okay. Oh, wait.
All right. Our sources of funding, about 77% from the state and 44% regional borrowing, and that's the council's funds. So our Parks and Open Space CIP, the purpose is to finance specific projects in regional parks and trails and to acquire land. And this chart illustrates the share of state funding versus regional borrowing that we put into each of those areas. So for specific projects, state bonds, Metro Council bonds are used for those projects. We use 60% state share. We match with 40% of the council's bonds. Specific projects coming from the Parks and Trails Fund, 90% of that goes to specific projects, and that's all funded by that source. Land acquisition, we use 10% of the Parks and Trails Fund dollars that are available for us, and again, we do a 60-40 split between those shares. And then finally, specific projects that are funded by state bonds, we pass through those grant funds. And your question to parks agencies, we do require a 25% match.
Okay, and let's say it's they make that investment, and it's several years before they actually develop the parkland. What is there something within the paperwork here that shows what you're spending to maintain that land in the meantime? And is that the Met Council's expense? Is that the local unit of government's expense?
Madam Chair, I don't have that specific information with me. We do have an appropriation that is for operations and maintenance, and I'm assuming it would be a part of that, but I don't have that specific information.
And is there any going back once that purchase is made if the city decides that they would really rather develop that land or make some other use out of it? Is there any going back?
Madam Chair, that would have to be a part of the regional plan that's done for parks as well as the local government comprehensive plan. So it would be an amendment to those.
And so once those things are... Once those plans are given to the Met Council, they're set in stone, there's no flexibility?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I would use a set-in-stone description of that, but the conversation would need to take place because there's infrastructure needed to support a different use of that land. So both transit, wastewater, all those pieces, if you were to develop land, is different than if you were to have it as parks land.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving on, I just put this slide in the package so you could see the split of the state and Met Council bonds for Park CIP and from the Parks and Trails Fund. And this just shows how the agency shares of those in our CIP would look. So you can kind of see what areas are getting what funds. And finally, coming kind of back to your question again of local match. This is the Parks Acquisition Opportunity Grants, and we granted $26.9 million since 2001 to partially finance land acquisition. That's about 2,000 acres that we've acquired. 75% is Parks Opportunity Grants, and the remaining 25% local match. And again, this slide shows how the Parks and Open Space CIP goes out over the 6 years of the CIP. $65 million has been authorized, $124 million. This next slide shows the council's proposed and now adopted payable 2013 property tax levies, $78.5 million. That represents a 1.6% increase plus the City of Ramsey's decision to join the transit taxing district, which brings us up to a 2% increase. You can see by the green highlighted areas of the pie chart here that the largest part of our levy, over 50% of our levy, over 60% of our levy, is related to debt service. So parks debt service and transit debt service are repaid by our property tax levy. Wastewater debt service are repaid from SAC and wastewater fees. Our general purposes levy at $10.7 million is a decrease from last year. Our levy limit for general purposes is $14.1 million, so we are well under our levy limit. The REL, TIBRA, LCDA are all statutory amounts as well. We have raised our LCDA levy over last year, and that was to build in some of that flexibility to fund some transit-oriented development grants. And those are for specifically grants for projects that are along our transitway corridors. This next chart shows the impact of our regional borrowing through the levies and fees necessary to support our debt service. You can see that both the transit and parks levies remain relatively flat over the term of our CIP, and that the environmental services is consistently growing. Environmental services growth is just a little bit above the inflation rate at about 2.5%. And again, the debt service represents about 45% of the operating budget for environmental services. That actually compares very favorably to our peer agencies across the nation, 45% of the operating budget supporting debt service. This next slide shows the changes in property tax levies for metropolitan area units of government since pay 2003. And you can see by the council's red line on the bottom that over that time period of 10 years, our levy has increased by 13.1%. The dotted line below shows what it would have changed had City of Ramsey, Columbus, and other local governments not chosen to join the transit taxing district. So the bottom line is the levies that the council would have put forward. The black line there with the orange diamonds on it, that shows the rate of inflation. And I have it updated through pay 2011. It's 36.8%, so the council's levy increases have been well under the rate of inflation. And then the other lines there show school districts, cities, and counties, and the increases that they have implemented over that time frame. This next slide shows our regional borrowing, and we expect to borrow about $1 billion over this six-year term of the CIP. You can see the parks and open space there is pretty even at about $7 million of borrowing, and we actually pay about $7 million, so it's pretty level. You'll see for transit, it's kind of lumpy, and that's related to how we issue debt. So we issue debt based on our cash flow needs. So we need our authority well in advance because it takes up to a couple, 3 years from the time you order a bus to the time you pay for the bus. So I have to have my authority in place when I order the bus, but I don't issue my bonds until I pay for the bus. And so you'll kind of see that lumpiness in our regional borrowing year to year. As we move to the next slide and talk about our outstanding debt, we smooth that lumpiness out by looking at our maturities so that we don't have outstanding debt that's as lumpy as how we issue the debt. So if you look at transit, in this case, the blue line there, you can see it's pretty level year to year over the life of the CIP. Our wastewater debt, again, is growing. But I do want to look at this last slide here, and that talks about how we compare with our peer agencies when it relates to wastewater debt per capita. And you can see that, again, the Council of Environmental Services stacks up very well against our peers. And, Madam Chair, I've come to the end of our presentation.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Senator-elect Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. People are really tripping over what to call me. The only thing I didn't see in here is any mention of the groundwater study. And I know you have sort of a commission working on groundwater, and I visit with them regularly because in my area it's kind of a big issue with the lakes and the use of water by communities. And as I understand it, in the Hugo, they were supposed to do a water system, but with all the problems, they're allowing more wells instead. And so is there anything in here under environmental services that's looking at the groundwater problem and monitoring system?
Madam Chair, Senator-elect Scalzi, the council has a $1.366 million request out of the Clean Water Fund to continue our work related to the water supply issues here in the metro area. It's recommended by the Clean Water Council as well. We we seek those monies through the legacy funds. I can't speak specifically to the Hugo issue, but I can certainly find out what work we're doing on that right now. I do know that the council is working with other folks on issues related to White Bear Lake and issues that are going on there with the water table, falling so significantly. But I do know that you're referencing to a committee that the council has. It's the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee, and that is a work that we do through the Clean Water Funds that we are seeking to continue that work in this next legislative session. $600,000 for 2014 and $7.66 million for fiscal year 15.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
And exactly what would that money be used for? Is it for monitoring wells, or is it for personnel, or how would that money be used?
Mr. Shetland.
Well, Senator-elect Scalzi, I will send you that information when I get back to my office. I have it. We presented it last week in our budget meeting with Clean Water Funds. I just need to get it.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it relates specifically to wells, but that may be that Clean Water Fund. There's $185.9 million, I believe, in that account. It's dispersed amongst a number of agencies. Bowser receives some. Ag receives some. Department of Health. The Department of Economic Development, all of those share in the distribution of those funds. Excuse me, the Pollution Control Agency as well. And some of that work must be related to wells, and I'll figure out where that's going.
Senator-elect Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I guess what I'm getting at is that we still have some companies in the metro area that are using once-through cooling. They're using water from the aquifer to do once through cooling for their plants, and then they're simply dumping it on the ground. And some cities are using deep wells, and some cities are using Mississippi River water. I mean, there's a number of ways that we're providing water for our people, and also we do have a number of conservation techniques for water costs. So I'm just kind of wondering, through this Water Supply Advisory Committee, are we looking at those once-through cooling, and do we have a total of what those once-through cooling people are using?
Madam Chair, Senator-elect Scalzi, one of the reasons why this whole advisory committee was created, it was back when Representative Denny Osment served in the House and Senator Linda Higgins carried the bill in the Senate, and Denny represented Koch Refinery at the time, which is now Flint Hills. And we were talking specifically about once through water that was going through the refinery, and we found a way to reuse that water, capture that water, in order to use it more efficiently. And so I can't tell you exactly. I'm not the expert on that, but I do know that that was the impetus for why we created this advisory committee in the first place. So what I'm going to do is set up a meeting with you, with our water folks, and we'll just come down and go into more detail with that on you. I think that that we'll be able to answer your questions at that time.
Any further comments or questions? Thank you so much for being here today, and thanks. I'm glad we finally got through the budget after several attempts, so thank you for your time and efforts to be here.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And before we adjourn, or I don't know if we ever really officially called to order, I guess, because we didn't have a quorum, but I just wanted to thank both House and Partisan staff for all the help that you've been on this commission. And my hope is that that it won't go back to dormancy, that someone will keep this going, and so that the public the citizens can have some assurances that there's a little bit of oversight over local, over this metropolitan governance issue. And thank you for the participants on the committee, although we're down to just a few of you still being here. But I just want to thank you all. And with that, have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Keep the gavel regardless. Thank you.
thank you for keeping this committee going. And generous.